Earth cannot see us. Seismic detectors cannot feel us. 'Cause we're cloaked. Come at the hour, come at the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM. Hello, my friends. Happy to be with you for another Saturday night edition of the program. I'm so excited. I have a brain-mouth interface failure on occasion. And that's one of those things that really doesn't look good in court. You know, speaking of what Google Earth can do, Australia's top secret sites uncovered by Google Earth. I am certain that they really appreciate that quite a bit. China's population has now hit 1.354 billion people. 1,354 million people. A comforting tidbit, India to store missiles near Pakistan and China borders. Well, that should provide some good access for some. Just another thing to keep you awake in the middle of the night when you're going, when's it going to hit me? Don't worry about it. Probably be a soap chip in the bathtub before a nuclear weapon. Tonight on the program, we have Richard C. Hoagland. He went down to the land of the Mayans. He whipped out his computer apparatus and he made some measurements. And there were some federal-type people, not our feds, their feds, Mayan feds, that wanted to talk with him about that. What are you measuring? And we're going to get into HAARP, which comes toward the climax of his initiative down there during the big 12-21-12 shindiggery. First, we will have a little update from Dan Johnson. Dan Johnson's been on the program before. He is an exemplary individual. And he will bring us up to date on the NDAA because I'm sorry, but I'm not letting it go. And here's something else that's not letting us go. This is a new story published yesterday. Fukushima debris hits Hawaii. Debris set adrift by the 2011 Japanese tsunami has made its way to Hawaii, triggering concerns over the unknown effects of the radiation it may carry from the meltdown of the Fukushima reactor. This is not going away. From ENE News, a mayor says, I'm losing my hair and have nosebleed every day. I asked for a blood test at a hospital in Tokyo because I'm exposed, but they refused it. So it seems that governments behave in the same way, mostly in a crisis, as every other government. You know, we do touch on things people may think are politically sensitive, but more than that, we really discuss philosophy. We discuss socio-philosophy, geo-socio-philosophy, geo-intelligence, individual intelligence, and also the concept of smarts. Smart being the practical application of intelligence. You know what I mean? So let's just say that going back through the history books, I don't get new ones, I get old ones, rather than revised ones or redacted ones. And I'm just getting the sense that I have not seen such fervor since about 1936 in Adolf Hitler's Germany. So we'll just see how it all sorts out. One thing's for sure, we were told that may you live in interesting times was an old saying. But it's not an old saying, it's actually an old curse. And I'll tell you what, if these aren't interesting times, they'll certainly do until the interesting times get here. Let us bring upon the bridge of the mothership into the global living room, one Dan Johnson. On the count of one. One.
Hello.
And there he is. Hey, now Dan Johnson I'm going to save this top part for later, but he's recognized as one of the top 30 impromptu speakers in the United States. Political science major, Bowling Green State University. And he has a PANDA update. That's People Against the National Defense Authorization Act, PANDA, pandaunite.org. And also, your other website is just peopleagainstndaa.com, you know, so you have two of them.
They both direct to the same place, yeah.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Pandaunite.org is easier to spell.
Well, all right, man. Bring us up to speed on what's going on with this thing, because it hasn't gone away, but I understand there is mounting and rising opposition to it.
Absolutely. It has not gotten away, first of all. On January 4th, Barack Obama signed it back into law, NDAA 2013, with no constitutional protections, and he didn't even complain this time that there was no constitutional protection. I'm sure you remember last year, and he said, I'd never use this power, I'd never use this power, and this year, not a peep. Nothing is heard.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the global theater, if you will, going on in the Senate and the House, all of these amendments that supposedly would do something and never actually would, touted around like, we're going to protect your rights, calm the restless natives. And all of those came to nothing, and Barack Obama ended up signing the NDAA 2013 with really very little, if any, effect on our rights that were taken away by the 2012 NDAA. But as far as mounting resistance is concerned, we have several states, and we've been working on this for about a year now, getting into position, getting crews ready, getting the connections, and getting our strategy written out and ready to go. And now, almost half of the United States is moving towards stopping the National Defense Authorization Act.
This is good news.
Here are some of the states which have already introduced legislation against the NDAA, and I'm sure your coast listeners will hear at least some of their states mentioned: Massachusetts, Michigan, Indiana, West Virginia, North and South Carolina, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Wyoming, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, and Washington. We're also working, have legislation drafted, or almost have legislation drafted, in Kansas, Georgia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Wisconsin, and Montana.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's some very good news. And, you know, I've got this little promo. Every time I hear it, I go, oh, gosh, it's that guy again. But it's true. People are getting into this. I must say that if one thing that's really good that's come out of all this chaos and uncertainty, it's that people are now engaging. They're going, wait a minute. I can send an email. I can send a letter. I can talk to friends. I can make calls. We can talk about this. And they do. Uh-huh. And the thing that I'm really delighted about, frankly, Dan, is that this is the part I was saving for last, is you're 19. Unless you had a birthday recently, you're 19. You're still 19. And a young man, and you're engaged in this. Do you find that some of your contemporaries are also engaged in this, or are you out there by yourself at 19? You're the only 19-year-old that's involved in this, or are there some... You know, when you get up there where I am, you say other kids, but I'm going to say other young men involved in this, in your demographic.
I find that my demographic, and I would say it's partly because of the Ron Paul revolution, which goal was never to really gain the presidency, but always to educate the American people through the presidential process, has really activated a lot of my generation. Has really activated a lot of the younger generation. And I think my generation is really looking towards liberty, is really looking toward freedom, is really, there's a huge influx of people who know the Constitution. There was a guy in my college class a few days ago who stood up and when people were asking what signs of government he found, he said, I have the Bill of Rights and Constitution hanging in my room. And so you have my generation has really taken a very much of an interest in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and a lot of them are really realizing where our country's going. In fact, a lot of the legislation that's been introduced has been introduced or really pushed by people of my generation. I mean, you got Tyler Smith out there in Georgia. He's a very young guy pushing out there in Georgia. And Missouri, you got Heather. She's a young gal out there. So, yeah, my generation is really, really paying attention and really getting involved.
Tell us right quick how people can become more involved. Can they go to your website and get wise to this and take it from there pretty easily?
Absolutely. We need to bring some serious pressure. PandaUnite.org and go to the Join Us tab. That's PandaUnite.org. Go to the Join Us tab, and we need to bring some serious pressure to these states. The more people join us, the better. This is the home stretch.
You know, an author named Neil Howe, we've had him on the program before, said that your generation is going to be the one that fixes this. And I'll tell you what, it sounds like you're engaged in this battle, because in the end, freedom is what it's all about. You know, and not the kind of freedom where we're so free we're running around, you know, killing each other because we have no morals. Freedom without morals is total chaos. But educated, analytical people like yourself, and I did not mean to leave out the young ladies either. I'm sure there are a number of young ladies of your demographic that are also engaged. And I commend you all. I got to bail right now, Dan, but we're going to bring you on from time to time. I don't mean like months, you know, apart, months between occasions, because we want to stay on this. The NDAA is a very dangerous piece of, it's not even legislation. It's, I don't know what it is. It's an act.
It's a dangerous piece of tyranny that brings the law of war to American soil and allows military force, the American military or international military, to be used against Americans to strip them of their constitutional rights and to strip them of everything that makes us different, everything that makes us American.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what Bill Maher said recently? The Second Amendment is anachronistic. Being a proud gun owner is stupid. You have no rights left to protect. That could possibly be the most genius thing that Mayor's ever said. Thanks for joining us, Dan. I really appreciate you being here. I got to bail. All right, take care. Dan Johnson. Go to his website, pandaunite.org. Or peopleagainstndaa.com, if that's easy to remember. All right, make way for the great Richard C. Hoagland. He will join us momentarily on the one and only Coast to Coast AM. A little bit later on in the program, we will speak with Ann Blake Tracy. She hadn't been on the program since she was on with Ship's Chaplain Punnett back in June of 2009. And if you want a little warm-up to that, you can look at one of her websites, SSRIstories.com. We're going to talk about drugs, the legal kind, and exactly what kind of damage they're doing. But first, you've heard of the shotgun out the back door. Well, this is the bazooka shot out the back door, which is a little bit rough on the other people in the kitchen, but it comes in the form of Richard C. Hoagland. Welcome back, Richard. Good to have you.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here on this great evening in the great American Southwest.
I'm telling you, it's just a beautiful thing, don't you know?
It sure is.
Well, no, you and I haven't spoken since you went down to Mayan country and went to those pyramids. So what happened?
Well, we got ourselves into a bit of an adventure. I mean, it didn't start out that way. It started out as this extraordinary cruise on the epic date of the end of the Mayan calendar, 2012, mm-hmm. the 13th Baktun, with a few hundred of our nearest friends who came with us on this grand ship called the Carnival Triumph, which was a pretty classy ship. And the crew on the ship turned themselves inside out to help us make certain things happen. Like when I do these things, I've done one recently before, like about a year ago in March of 2011. And I introduced the idea to the organizers that we should do nightly sky watches from the upper deck. Because most people who live in the country, I mean, the country of the United States, live in cities. They don't live in the country like you probably grew up in the country, like I did.
Right.
And you could see the sky. Without city lights, without the dimming effect of, you know, megawatts of candle power beamed uselessly up into space from road signs and street lights and, you know, neon and all that.
Yeah, city people get out there in the country and go, good grief, what's all that?
I know, they're freaked out. I remember the first time I was driving from Tucson out to Kitt Peak. I'd rented a car, and I was going up to Kitt Peak, which is the kind of national observatory site in the southwestern U.S. back then. This was in the 70s. and I'm driving along, heading kind of west-southwest, and I suddenly slam on the brakes and pull off to the side of the road because I think there's a forest fire to my left, out the left-hand driver's window. And I stopped and I looked again, and it was the center of the galaxy. It was the center of the Milky Way. It was so bright, John, that I thought there was a brush fire. And in the west, where there's dry tinder and little rain, you know, when you see a fire, you should kind of pay attention.
Yeah, not good.
It was amazing. So I wanted to bring, because there's only two places left on Earth where you can really see the sky the way our great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers used to see it, which is from deserts or from the ocean, from the sea.
Yeah.
And the problem with the sea on cruise ships is they have these damn things all lit up. Every deck has neon and fluorescent and, you know, I mean, it's just, so half the voyage is spent convincing the captain and the bridge crew to turn out lights. Well, I was able to get, finally, like about the third night, the lights turned out on limited portions of the upper decks near the stern and near the bow of the ship, right behind the bridge.
Yeah.
And we had people come up and we had them look, and I had this gargantuan laser pointer, which is the mother of all laser pointers, because you can actually point out things like Orion and Sirius and other stars in a cloudless sky, just with the scattering of sea spray coming from the bow. And people were aghast and astonished and amazed and awed by what they could see, because you can never see this from land in cities anymore, certainly not even Central Park, and most of us live, unfortunately, in cities. So that was part of what I wanted to build into this experience. The other thing that I had kind of convinced the organizers to do was to let me take an away team of participants into Chichen Itza on the morning of the 19th, which is when we docked at a place on the Yucatan shore called Progreso, and then you take buses for a couple hours inland to Chichen Itza, which is this sprawling classic Mayan complex where they built structures and temples and platforms and this massive pyramid called the Kukulcan Pyramid. And that's the one where at the equinoxes in September and in March, at sunset and sunrise, you can see this snake-like creature in the shadows rippling up and down the stairways because of the way the Mayans built it. So the shadows literally show you Quetzalcoatl, which is what Kukulcan means in Mayan. So what I wanted to do was, coming off about 8-9 years of these measurements, I wanted a bunch of people to help me measure for the first time, a group, to help me measure in other ways than with scientific instrumentation. While I'm doing the science, I wanted them to be in little notebooks or on their cell phones or iPads or whatever, you know, gadget they had with them, moment to moment to moment, what they felt. Because a lot of people on this cruise were spiritually oriented, and we had a Mayan elder named Hombudsman with us who was leading his own separate group of about 100 people. Well, I had 50 in mine. And one of the organizers was very surprised that half the people that wanted to go ashore wanted to play with me and the science and not with sitting, you know, cross-legged at the base of the pyramid and kind of meditating. And I found that interesting, too, because it meant there were people wanting to kind of confirm with Western 21st century modalities some of these ancient truths and wisdoms that have been handed down for generation upon generation upon generation. So the plan was to take these people, take a two-hour bus trip to Chichen Itza, get off, go in, and wander around and have them kind of watch me do the measurements while they took notes about what they were feeling, and some of them would go off and maybe meditate. And, you know, we had some people actually do that and send me their results after, which I'll get to in a minute. All of that the night before we're supposed to dock at Progreso on the morning of the 19th, which is 2 days before the solstice, right? You're in that zone. You're in the window.
Right.
The night before we're to start all this, we get word on the ship that all security measures have been so tightened that nothing, not even a cell phone, is going to be allowed into the site, which means my laptop, my scientific instrumentation, the Accutron, all that, were totally banned. Which means everything I'd planned for 8 years to do at Chichen Itza, I couldn't get done. Plus, you had 50 people who signed up and paid money to go and do this with me.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's hold up right there, and let's come back with what you did about that, shall we?
Okay.
Very good. Richard C. Hoagland is our guest tonight for the, well, we got about an hour and a half with him. This is the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. Do stand by. Richard C. Hoagland, he's an adventurous man. He thought it was going to be a nice cruise, a little stargazing with a few hundred of his closest friends. He'd go down to Chichen Itza, take a few measurements, and by the time it was all over with, he almost got himself pulled into a real jackpot. We'll hear the details in just a moment when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, so Richard Hoagland, so what... You were trying to take your measurements, and they didn't want you to take them, and they didn't want you to read them, and bring us back up to speed, and get us back up to warp here.
Well, the night, the ship metaphor is totally appropriate here, because a ship at sea is kind of like the closest thing to a spaceship that most of us will ever get to experience. That's why doing these star things from the upper deck to me was quite important, because I want to connect people back to our heritage in terms of the environment in which we really have grown up. The Earth in space, orbiting the sun, orbiting a star, orbiting the center of the galaxy, alignments, precessions, planets coming in and out of you. That's the history of our ancestry, looking at the sky. So this is kind of like a prelude to the science I was intending to do with this group of people, very dedicated, very devoted followers of our work, who paid extra money besides just, the passage on the ship to come and watch me and participate in doing this. I mean, the context, John, here is these measurements go back for me about 8 years. In theory, they go for me back about 30 years. God, that makes it sound old. To when I first realized there were ancient ruins on Mars. And my colleagues like Errol Torrent at Defense Mapping and Stan Tennant at the Meru Foundation and many, many others, I mean, I spent the whole evening just mentioning names, we all figured out in bits and pieces that the geometry of the layout of the ruins on Mars was designed to memorialize, to immortalize the fundamental geometry of the physics of how the universe works. And part of that uncoding had to do with figuring out that our own ancestors on this planet, the ancient Maya, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Hindu, the ancient Chinese, the ancient everybody, knew this same physics and incorporated it in all these sacred sites all over the world, starting with the biggies, the pyramids, Mayan and Egyptian. Stonehenge, and you can go down the list from there. That was the model, and around 2004, I was able to go from theory, which I'd written in my first book on all this called The Monuments of Mars, The City on the Edge of Forever,
right,
segue from theory into what science really has to be based on, which is observation. You can have all the neat theories in the world, as you know, John, but if you make an observational notation that conflicts, really violates the theory, you got to throw the theory out.
Sure.
So the really cool part for me is when through the offices of another friend who unfortunately up and died on us in the early 90s before we got to the good stuff, physicist Bruce De Palma, who is brother of the famous director Brian De Palma.
Yes.
I put together a digital analog version of his analog torsion field measuring system based around an old 1965 Accutron watch. And with that and a laptop computer and some electronics and some algorithms, and a program or two, I was able to go to these various ancient sites. Robin and I, part of Enterprise, funded sometimes by a television network, like in 2009 when NBC Sci-Fi sent us to Mexico and Tikal in Central America, in Guatemala. Other times, privately funded by people who donated money to Enterprise, like the incredibly devoted crew we have on our Facebook pages, both the fan site and the friend site. They've been incredibly supportive, and their rewards are coming soon when they see some astonishing data that their support has actually been able to help us discover. Doing all this over the last 8 years, the creme de la creme, the ultimate goal for me was to measure in the heart of Maya country at the end of the Mayan calendar in 2012, the torsion field physics that I had confirmed in the field, pun intended, experimentally at places like Teotihuacan and Tikal and in England at Stonehenge and Silbury Hill and at American monuments built on the same knowledge base by private guys like the guy who built Coral Castle there south of Miami at the Homestead. All of this then kind of funneled down to what I was trying to do on the afternoon of December 19th, which was to take this database of previous measurements and the theory of the hyperdimensional torsion field model going all the way back to the early 80s when we figured out that the Martians who left all that Martian stuff at Sedona and other places had been trying to tell us about this crucial way the universe really works. And it all came down to measuring these pyramids and other temples at Chichen Itza on the 19th.
Why do you figure it's temples?
Well, because human beings tend to make sacred out of anything they don't understand.
Right.
And when you have a physics that can literally reach out and change reality, that kind of falls into the category of things people don't immediately understand, but they tend to worship. And we have a lot of records, both Mayan hieroglyphs and Egyptian hieroglyphs, that these incredible architectural edifices, is that a word, were created to amplify this unseen force, this torsion field that I keep talking about. And if you amplify it enough, it has real world physical manifestations in the ordinary 3D reality that we live in. And I can later, you know, in this story, demonstrate by some of the things that happened at Chichen Itza that totally reinforced, despite huge efforts to stop us from getting these measurements, exactly what I've been prognosticating about for the last 8 years.
Richard, let me ask you something. Many people who know your work and have read your material, read your books, know your material, at least what's in those books, almost as well as you do. However, for new listeners, and just to amplify this, what is the nature? I mean, there's so many, there's all kinds of theoretical physics studies and professors and doctors out there looking at stuff that they think these things, well, in their minds, they exist in theory. And they endeavor to make them practical and go, yes, this is no longer a theory. This is the real thing. This is all leading up to what is the nature of this torsion field?
Okay,
I mean, what is this? Because some people say, oh, this is pseudoscience and blah, blah. Well, there's a lot of pseudoscience out there that turns into, and when they say pseudo, that makes it sound like imitation. So I'd prefer to call it nouveau science rather than pseudoscience.
Well, pseudo is a definite denigration to the idea that it doesn't exist. It's all in your mind. It's a hoax. It's fake. It's
exactly.
It's not real. No, torsion field physics is not pseudoscience. It's real science. There are thousands, tens of thousands of peer-reviewed papers on torsion field physics in the physics journal all over the world.
Is it basically just an energy field that is other dimensional, but it as you just said a minute ago, it manifests itself in our 3D reality here.
All right, let's start at the basics. Let's begin with the credibility thing. Torsion field physics is mainstream physics that most of the mainstream doesn't know about, because there was a definite campaign by the security services, the CIA and the KGB in the U.S. and the Soviet Union, up until the wall came down in Berlin and the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 90s, to keep the research in these fields totally top secret. Because this is a physics that is the bottom foundation of reality. It is what all the other science studies in physics prescind from. And the proof of this is that up until the mid-90s, for which we have statistics, something like 10 to 20,000 papers had been published, as I just said, in the peer-reviewed literature all over the world. Over half of those papers have Russian authors, and they were sealed behind the Iron Curtain by Stalin and his descendants, because this is the stuff whereby extraordinary weapons can be made. What do we always classify, John? The stuff you can turn into things to kill people.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Everything.
Yeah. Torsion physics in the wrong hands kills people and can kill a lot of people. Talk about weapons of mass destruction. It is the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. And at the risk of starting a bonfire that will not go out for the rest of the evening, I will just tell you that what brought down the World Trade Towers in New York on 9/11 was a torsion field weapon.
Now, does this go back to Tesla? Is this what he was working with?
This was a variant of what he was working on. The other problem, John, is because it hasn't been mainstreamed because of political reasons for keeping it in the closet, keeping it out of the sight of most people, everybody, every physicist, every scientist, every institution, every government agency that trips over this and starts to do experiments and starts building equipment to make it work for them, they give it a totally different name. So you've got the same physics under 1,000 different, nom de plumes. It's been called ether physics. It's been called scalar physics. It's been called torsion physics. It's been called all kinds of things. It's all the same stuff. It's manipulating the ether, which is the foundation of atoms and molecules and electromagnetic fields. The ether is the foundation of reality. I have a friend, Paul LaViolette, who's a genius physicist, lives back in New York. He's written umpteen books on this, and he calls it quantum kinetics. It's every guy who figures this out comes up with a new name. And the only way you standardize names, going back through the historical record, is when everybody kind of agrees on the same thing, is called the same thing. But sure. If you have a politically fragmented situation where, by design, everybody is kept apart, no one can come together. You can't have conferences in the mainstream in the light of day on torsion field physics, because in the Soviet Union, the KGB would attack all the scientists who felt this was real and did experiments like Kozarev. And in the West, the CIA takes out after you. Or in the more recent instance, there seem to be parts of the Mexican government that don't want this kind of out in the light of day and in the mainstream and openly discussed. So we are dealing with a suppressed science. If you want a tutorial on this, I would advise you to either get a guy named Joseph Farrell on your show as a guest, Dr. Farrell, or start reading his voluminous books. I mean, Joseph can write like a book a month, and it's got depth and it's got references and it's real science. He's an Oxford PhD. He can run rings around most of the rest of us who take years to write one book. He can write an incredible book in a month and does excellent homework. And so if you want a real tutorial in the history of torsion field physics and how the Nazis were involved and the Soviets were involved and the U.S. government was involved and the so-called Philadelphia experiment seems to be part of the secret field, all of this stuff aggregates down to the same stuff, which is it's suppressed science, it's the way the universe really works, it's what Einstein was looking for through his entire career, the so-called unified field theory. torsion physics is the unified field, and those buildings came down in New York because somebody, and I can't tell you tonight who, but somebody used it to destroy two 1,500-foot skyscrapers in seconds.
You believe this. You realize that. I know you realize the gravity of what you are saying.
And I gave a whole presentation in Amsterdam a couple, 3 years ago, laying out the point-by-point case building on the work of a brilliant genius named Dr. Judy Wood, who George got on and actually interviewed. And then I was able to get a copy of Dr. Wood's book, which is sitting here on my desk, called Where Did the Towers Go? I was able to get a copy of that book, which is a meticulous second-by-second recounting of all the evidence around 9/11 and the fact that those buildings didn't collapse. They were dematerialized. They were dustified, to use her term.
That's pretty strong stuff, Richard.
It's in the data. I was able to get a copy of Wood's book into the hands of Jesse Ventura. Jesse Ventura went on national radio shows and started talking about Dr. Judy Wood, and then suddenly weird things started happening in Jesse's life, and he shut up. Because
it's
the touchstone to what really happened on 9/11. Now, you got to open your mind really big and say, if somebody in our reality has that kind of physics and technology and exercised that as a demonstration on 9/11 to the power structure, who did it, why did they do it, and where are they now? And has the entire Al-Qaeda 9/11 post-war on terror really been a two-tier war, where at one level we're fighting with, you know, a bunch of guys that call themselves Al-Qaeda, but at the other level we're secretly fighting the real enemy who has this kind of technology at their disposal and obviously are not afraid to use them based on this physics, which, to come back to where we started, I was taking a group of civilians on a cruise ship to the Yucatan, to the heart of Maya country, on the dawning date of the end of the Mayan calendar in 2012, to measure in an ancient monument in the middle of another country, surrounded by the security forces of a nation which is not the United States.
Right.
And I was told the night before I was going to go in and take these measurements, no, you can't do this.
You can't do this.
You cannot do this.
That's pretty strong too, Richard.
Well, because it threw a monkey wrench into everything that we had planned.
Well, I'm sure, but doesn't it just speak volumes about you can't do this?
Well, it made no sense. I mean, here we are on a ship approaching at 20, 25 knots, whatever the ship was doing that night. And just before dinner, we had a meeting. The ship's cruise staff and I and the organizers of the, you know, Mayan Galactic Cruiser, which is what this seminar was called.
Yeah.
And they informed me that they had received word from the authorities at Chichen Itza that I could not take my laptop or measurement equipment in the site. It was
forbidden. Man, that is
forbidden.
Just ridiculous,
of
Richard.
Course. Because if you look, and I'll describe in the next, you know, segment, when we got in there, we saw a zillion people dressed in every conceivable fashion, celebrating the end of the Mayan calendar, doing what people usually do at these sites. You know, they basically play tourist, right?
Yes.
And every one of them had a Palm Pilot, you know, an Android, an iPhone, whatever. And there's a zillion people all trying to find, you know, Wi-Fi links so they can talk to their grandmother up in Poughkeepsie about the wonderful time they're having.
Okay. You hear the tunes in the background. We got to let our local affiliates, our beloved local affiliates, do their thing, do a little top of the hour news and all of that. But I got a feeling you took your measurements anyway, didn't you?
I'm good.
That's what I hear.
When we come back.
All right, Richard C. Hoagland is our guest. We've got another hour with him, and then we will welcome back after quite a long hiatus, Anne Blake Tracy. Remember the expression, going postal? Mm-hmm. We forgot that one. I'm happy that we had reason to forget it, but morphed into something else, didn't it? All right, I digress. We'll be back with Richard shortly. Stand by, please. This is the one and only Coast.